runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell and Greg Hughes. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 214 with guest Kevin Klein, recorded Thursday, May 19th, 2011. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow the boys on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Hey, this is Richard Campbell. I'm at Tech Ed in Atlanta, down on the expo hall floor, sitting in the blogger section and talking to my friend Kevin Klein. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about the 10-pound beer.
Yes, indeed.
What party was that? It was the Influencers party at Stats.
Okay.
On Tuesday.
Yes.
And somebody found this 3-liter beer glass.
Unbelievable beer glass.
Filled it up with Yingling beer and gave it to me.
Oh.
And I drank it.
I was going to say, that's the second part of the story, because just because it was given to you doesn't mean you have to drink it.
There was poor decision making on my part too here.
So. Indeed.
Yeah. Anyway, I finished it.
Good job.
And then they took me back to the hotel.
That's right. They poured you out of the glass at that point, right?
Yeah. I've got some good friends who hustled me off in a cab.
That's right.
I woke up the next morning like, well, that was pretty stupid.
Yeah, you know, but it's quite an achievement. So
it certainly made the rounds on Facebook.
Yeah, that's so right. That's good stuff.
It's a lot of beer.
Yeah.
What have you been doing at Tech Ed?
Well, this year at Tech Ed, we've got a lot of interest in cloud and a lot of interest in Denali.
Mm-hmm.
So Denali is firming up. There's going to be a new CTP sometime.
Is he figured to be called SQL 2012 probably?
I don't think so. Really? I think the rumor going around right now, and again, hearsay, this probably summer of this year.
Right. So it might be 2011.
It might be 2011. Yeah.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of people are excited about that.
Mm-hmm. SQL Server has, you know, how much more can they do? It's a great product. It's been a great product for a while. So I guess the question is, what are they adding that is going to be that compelling that we're going to want to upgrade?
Well, I'm sure the SQL Server team will take that as flattery.
You made a great product a few years ago.
That's right.
How
do you top that, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Please don't gild the lily. Like this, it's pretty awesome.
There are other things in the market that always drive database innovation. So,
sure.
For example, you might be hearing a lot about NoSQL.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So there are these different kinds of NoSQL databases out there, which incidentally doesn't mean NoSQL. It means not only SQL,
right,
is the acronym for that.
And they're not necessarily anti-SQL. They're just a different approach to storing data.
Exactly. And so they are actually really good at some kinds of data.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means, hey, maybe we can incorporate some of the things that they do effectively into our relational data model. And one example of that that's coming out in Denali, which is public, you know, you can look it up now, is what's called the column index.
Okay.
So there's a new method of indexing that you can use that's kind of inspired by other non-relational sorts of approaches to data. It's column-based rather than row-based.
Right.
And for very large data sets, let's say you have a big multi-terabyte data warehouse or something like that, you can do queries that span what would normally be millions or billions of rows nearly instantaneously.
Wow.
Just super, super fast.
So how do you insert data into this? How different is it?
Well, it does take a little bit of a different, you know, for me, it was hard to wrap my head around.
Yeah, yeah. I've got the same reaction. I'm a data guy, and I'm like, you're doing what?
Yeah, exactly. So it's all column-oriented rather than row-oriented. And there are some really great demos here at Microsoft Tech Ed. There's also some stuff that you can look at online that show you how to kind of approach it if you're a relational person. It does take an amount of setup.
Right. So is this really suited for static sets, like not high transactional velocity, but a lot of complex querying?
It is well suited towards that sort of environment. It can do rapidly changing data. It can do that well.
Okay.
But you just can't add a column data store to an existing relational database and expect it to work well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is in its own database.
It could be in an existing database, but you probably wouldn't want to throw it onto the table that's laid out relationally. You probably want to set it up a separate sort of table to handle that, a separate sort of indexes to handle that. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
but that's got a lot of people buzzing. It's like, woo, you know, I can huge amounts of data instantly.
Yeah. Little Mozart in the morning, I guess.
I guess so.
What can you do?
Another thing that that we're seeing, it's a 21st century thing, is this whole big data sort of idea. Databases now, you know, each generation we see, you know, just a few years ago, having a 1 terabyte database was a big deal.
It was a big deal, yeah.
Before that, if you, 200 gigabytes? Wow, you are pushing the limit, you know. And way back when I started at NASA, we had a 130 gigabyte database, and that was, you know, freaking enormous, you know. So, and when you have very, very large, databases like that, your windows for preventative maintenance seem to get smaller and smaller.
For sure. And maintenance cycles take longer because it's so much data.
Exactly. So you have these two kind of competing business needs. You've got huge amounts of data you have to, let's say, get backed up.
Mm-hmm.
But you got less time than ever to do it.
Right.
It takes longer than ever to do it.
Yeah.
What are we going to do in a situation like that? So that's where Microsoft is introducing a new set of features. Really exciting. It's a bundle of features, I would say, but it's characterized as always on is the term they use.
Right.
And with always on, it builds on the database mirroring concept.
Okay.
And so there's a whole second server that, or possibly more than one, and it provides you lots of ways that you can do things like set up a second read-only server for reporting.
Right.
Very, very quickly. Or maybe you've got
stuff we've been doing by hand for years, but now this is automated tooling around it.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's very seamless. It's very self-maintaining, really slick stuff. Mm-hmm. Here's an example. In my really big databases, one thing that was always difficult was to do what we call a database consistency check to look for corruptions and then be able to do a backup. They would get so big that, well, tonight I will look at one table and do a corruption check on one table.
DBCC that's not out of that table. And then next day, the next one.
Exactly. And then, you know, by the end of the week or maybe a 2 week cycle, I would have gone through all of them.
Right.
Well, that leaves a lot of room for corruption to sneak in somewhere in the database somewhere. With always on, you can actually do many of your DBCC checks on the second server.
Right. So you're mirroring to a backup to a secondary server, doing all your... The question is, will mirroring really transmit the corruption? I guess it will.
It will catch all... It could allow a physical corruption to go through.
Right.
But it will catch all the logical corruptions.
Right.
So you will... you can kind of intercept and remediate there on your secondary rather than on your primary.
Right. Well, I guess the thing is, if you find corruption on the secondary, how do you clean it up for the primary?
Again, you've got like DBCC repair statements. The repair part, that's still difficult. You're still going to have to do some stuff by hand.
But the thing is, you're not doing it every day. You're only doing it when it actually occurs, and corruption doesn't happen that often. But
seldom, yeah.
Now that you've you'll detect it on the secondary machine, and then you know you got to go to the primary and do some serious cleaning.
Right. And for those really, really big databases where in the old setup, I might go 2 weeks without noticing it because I couldn't get back to that first table where the problem occurred.
Right, because you were rotating through.
Because I was rotating through.
But I guess if you want to get fancy, you could flop over to the backup machine and now that what was primary becomes a secondary and you can clean it up and
so forth. Yeah. So it provides, you know, a really seamless way to keep systems up and available and really neat ways of kind of, extending and scaling out that capability.
Sure. And these are things we have done by hand, right? I've set up servers where with log shipping and then you break the log ship and do tests on it or fail over to it. Like it's just that it was a lot of our own scripts. We had to build that.
Right.
Rather than, use a wizard.
Sure, sure. And, you know, and there's always the same problems, with those. In my own scripts and so forth, they were effective, but very brittle. They would break easily.
Sure.
You know, if I had to do customization and so forth, then that would take an additional round of tooling where I'd have to try and figure out how to get that.
Well, and every time we make changes, we've got to go back through and test all of that stuff again, make sure it still works.
That's right. Yeah. If a new, cumulative update comes out, it's like, ooh, boy, I got to do some regression testing.
Yeah.
You know, make sure it hasn't broken.
Yeah. I like not owning the code.
Amen. Indeed. And very well put, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's past that? Next okay. in the Denali list.
Some other things, of course, are going to be cloud focused. So we're seeing many, many new things that are really exciting, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. If you're thinking about cloud, not just on the feature list, like I'm not talking about things like SQL Azure,
right?
Which is, you know, a relational engine in the cloud. But
and there was some announcements around SQL Azure. I think they made it easier to transport data up and down.
That's right. So the data syncing mm-hmm. capability, and that's extremely important because cloud SQL Azure doesn't ship with I guess basically a backup facility.
And that's I'm thinking in terms of could I use SQL Azure as my backup data store? That I like having my database in my shop, and I like the way it runs and so forth. I don't really want to run another one. I don't want to set up a second data center. So can I just feed to SQL Azure that set of data? We could fail over to the cloud.
That's a great point. Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. You could do that. As long as you know, have done your testing that there's, you know, no subset of SQL Server features that you needed in the cloud.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of a question of, I get a lot of people say, oh, well, this SQL Azure doesn't have as many features as SQL Server on premises.
Yeah.
And, to me, the analogy is kind of like the 18-wheeler versus the Camry. Right. Sometimes we're asking our Camry application to haul 10,000 crates. In that right. case, you know, you need an 18-wheeler.
Sure.
But most of the time, most of us
most
get
of the time we're
forth.
Getting groceries with our 18-wheeler.
Yeah, exactly. And overspending enormously on
yeah.
it, right?
Yep.
So if you have a system that's primarily transaction processing, you know, mm-hmm. create, read, update, delete kind of work, gosh, yeah, put that in SQL Azure.
Sure.
Just like you're saying, put that backup up there. Yep. You don't need a second data center somewhere.
No.
You have great SLAs guaranteed from Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can do a lot of things, a lot of innovative things around that. Reduce your costs, extend your capability, provide that service to people that maybe was going to be very difficult to get, you know, to get that new data center set up.
And mostly costly, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And again, you end up owning a whole bunch of stuff you probably don't want to own.
Definitely the case. Definitely. You know, it's kind of like with electricity where they have to build power plants for peak usage,
right? Right?
When everybody turns on their air conditioner yeah. in Houston, right?
Yeah. I mean, 5 o'clock in the afternoon in Houston, right. power consumption is at its high end.
So with computing, it's the same way for most of us. We have yeah. to buy enough server resources to support when everything hits at once.
Yeah, the worst case scenario.
Right. But in cloud, we don't have to do that.
No.
You know, we can actually elastically scale out
yeah.
to a very large scale when we need it
mm-hmm.
and then drop way down to, you know, if you're a floral shop, for example.
Right.
Mother's Day and Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the year is pretty stable.
Yeah. Not a whole lot to do.
So. Right. So if you had bought servers to support Mother's Day and Valentine's Day, oh, what a big investment that would
yeah.
be. But with cloud, you don't have to do that now.
Yeah.
You could scale up and then scale back down to very little. But where I was going just a moment ago, mm-hmm. Richard, with things outside of SQL Azure.
Right.
For example, there's a really neat new tool called the System Center Advisor.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Part of the System Center suite.
Right.
There's a lot of tools in there. It's almost baffling at
yeah.
times.
So the idea here is that you can install an agent on each of your on-premises SQL server.
Okay.
The agent will monitor all your SQL servers and load the data into the cloud. Any of the DBAs or system admins can read the data from the interface provider.
So this is status data or instrumentation of the server?
It's actually configuration data.
Oh, okay.
So it will tell you, based on what we're seeing, you're actually, you actually need Service Pack 2, Cumulative Update 3, to get optimal performance for the things you're doing.
Huh. So is it actually looking at the types of transactional loads?
It looks at, you know, some of the more basic things, what's happening on the SQL Server. Mm-hmm. But at the first release, at least at this point, what it does is it's mainly looking at your errors that are coming up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it looks at your error logs and let's say, for example, it sees 1604, and I don't even know what 1604 is, but I'm just okay. throwing that number out.
Picking a number.
Right. And so it sees 1604 happening a lot in your system.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the 40,000 other people that are also using System Center Advisor, those people that get 1604 happen to have a particular DLL from a particular vendor.
Right.
So it says, you know what? If you're using vendor X's OLADBC driver, you know, ADO driver, if you upgrade it one version, those problems go away.
Interesting. This reminds me of Windows Update and the whole error reporting system in Windows, which, you know, same sort of thing. You get some weird error message. It says, can I send this up? And a little while, you know, after a few seconds comes back and says, hey, you need to update your video drivers.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, this uh-huh. is a known set of problems. So
right.
I'm excited at the idea that we're pushing that onto the server level and starting to use the gestalt right. of everybody's problems.
Exactly.
To sort of find best resolutions.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's always the kind of the best practices in the white papers. But at the end of the day, when you're, I know you experienced this. I've seen you talk with customers who say, yeah, but what are real people doing?
Yeah.
You know,
well, and talking about real hardware and their own foibles, right? Mm-hmm. And the way you're networking. Like, there's so many subtleties that create that particular situation.
Right.
But even then, it's still, you know, there are, how many really unique configurations are there actually? Most people in any given configuration, it's got to be thousands of them.
Indeed. It's dizzying.
Yeah.
To try and manage that.
It's a lot of servers.
Yeah, it is. But, like you said, now with the power of Web 2.0, in which we collaborate rather than just disseminate information,
right.
we can actually answer those questions.
Start pooling a bunch of that data together.
Right.
Well, it sounds like we could also get to an empirical point of what real best practice actually is.
Yeah.
Here is the most common configuration with the fewest problems.
Exactly. Wow. You know, that is a really neat idea.
Yeah, very interesting chunk of data you could get from that.
Gosh, yeah. And someone's going to figure out how to monetize that, too, at some point. So that's...
Well, we know where all the data is going to go. Microsoft's going to end up with it, so...
Right.
Well, hopefully they'll share it with us.
Exactly.
And, you know, uh-huh. I mean, it's great to get reports back on your own system to say, here are the things you ought to change.
But, right.
Yeah, I love that kind of statistical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Just looking at everything and saying, well, here's where people are really having success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I tend not to be a hardware snob, you know. I think Dell makes good gear. I mean,
oh, sure.
Packard makes good gear. Like,
mm-hmm.
There's lots of fine hardware out there.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
all have their foibles.
Exactly, you know. And they all have different kind of histories that they're trying to support.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a different a set of, you know, internal tools. And so HP Sim, you know, great tools like that. And, you know, the... Vendor X may have one way to tell what the CPU temperature is, and
yeah.
another vendor a different way, and so it is really interesting to see how those guys can bring that information together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually see the composite, and my expectation is there won't be one winner.
Right,
it'll show that there's plenty of configurations that work well, and they're all different. And,
sure, you know, yeah, excellent point.
Everybody's mm-hmm. workloads are different too, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to match all those things up. Anything else in the Denali stack we're missing? What's happening on the BI side?
BI has got lots of good stuff happening there. There is reporting services is coming down the pipe in the cloud.
Boy, that keynote demo of reporting services is the best one I've ever seen. Never been excited about reporting services before.
Oh, really?
They just knocked it out of the park.
Oh,
that's awesome.
Yeah, that's good stuff. So I think, and again, here's a kind of thing that I think IT is catching on to the fact that it really needs to be valuable to business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And most of the business people that we deal with, they don't want numbers. They don't want a spread. I mean, some of them do, but most of the people would really just rather have a really pretty graph,
yeah.
you know, or a pie chart or a thermometer bar or something like that.
Yeah, some kind of dashboardy. You're doing well, you're doing poorly.
Right.
You want the numbers after you get the results you didn't expect.
Right. Exactly. So I need to explore this. Give me the numbers.
Right.
But the rest of the time, what are my key performance indicators? What's the dashboard say?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what reporting services make really, really easy.
And I find it very challenging to try and build up a set of, you know, what Microsoft's trying to accomplish there with just here are the common KPIs. Which ones do you want to use?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's business is a little different. I mean, it's very challenging to get to the instrumentation that makes sense for any given business.
Indeed it is. Yeah.
And I just find it tricky to get into these tools and actually get down to the subset that matters to your particular case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's next for you, my friend?
Well, after this, actually, I'm looking forward to a well-deserved rest.
Ah, taking a little break.
5 weeks on the road, so finally I'll have a little time off. And then back in late summer, I'll be back on the road again, traveling a lot more.
That five weeks was not all conferences, though.
Mostly conferences,
really?
Yeah. So there is a set of kind of grassroots community-driven events called SQL Saturdays.
Oh, yeah. How are those going? You know, there's a few, like, the SharePoint folks are doing stuff like that, too.
Mm-hmm.
It feels rather code campish for the
right.
dev, you know, from coming from a dev perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about a SQL Saturday.
Yeah.
What does it look like?
So that's the same model, code camp. It's usually organized, let's say, by the, maybe if there's a SQL Server user group in a city, they'll cooperate with some sort of venue. Maybe it's a hotel. A lot of times it'll be a local university. It's typically free to attend. There'll be four tracks all day long.
Right.
Maybe you pay for lunch, you know, 10, 15 bucks.
Right.
And there's some vendor sponsors, so you can talk to Quest, Redgate, Idera, folks like that. Probably some local companies as well, some recruiters or, you know, IT hiring firms or staffing firms. And typically you will get at least a few really big name speakers. I've gone to six this year.
Right.
And as well as many local speakers who are talented and know their stuff too. So it's usually a great way. And we do get a lot of the development community there because their thought is, well, you know, I might not normally spend to go to something that's primarily SQL Server, but I've been meaning to brush up my skills on that. And, you know,
most apps have data.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'm mostly a VB guy, but I got to write a lot of select statements.
Right. You know, as a guy who plans a lot of content for different events and things, I would really want to take that into account. There's a different style of session you're going to do, that sort of querying for developers, that kind of thinking around that, that's quite valuable for that audience.
Right, exactly. So you do, in the audiences, I really enjoy the audience too, because you get to interface with people that usually, within a big IT organization at least, is rather insular.
Yes.
You know, so the DBAs go and eat lunch with the DBAs. You know, they don't see the developers too much, you know.
Do you actually see, like, large org DBAs show up to these things?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
That's good. Because it's the other species, you know, the Paul Randall's line, the accidental DBA, the guy, you were standing close to the server when the last guy quit, so now it's you.
That's right.
And they tend to be the jack-of-all-trades guys. Mm-hmm. You know, they know how to order gear, and they know how to get a server up and running more or less, so it won't fall over, and they're just trying to, what do I absolutely have to know? Because I'm really, really, really busy.
Right, right. And you definitely see that. And there's a lot of sessions that cater specifically to that kind of person. But you definitely will see plenty of high-end DBAs there as well.
Interesting.
Yep. Good stuff.
Yeah, different sets of topics there. How many people typically go to a SQL Saturday?
They've been drawing good crowds. And I think they probably have been the most successful thing that we've seen from new offering from PASS, the big professional association. In the last couple of years. So the smallest one I've been to has been a couple hundred people.
Right.
And the bigger ones that I've been to, say in Chicago and Dallas and whatnot, is 400 or 500 people.
Right. So what sort of venues? Is it? They're not in hotels, right?
Sometimes in a really large, kind of in a larger hotel, but most of the time they're done in a local college.
Right.
So,
free space, basically.
Free, you know, it's less expensive, but that's how they, you know, they keep those prices down.
Yeah.
And, so with, you know, 300-400 people, you gotta accommodate all of those folks somewhere. Mm-hmm. So those universities or the training centers and things like that usually do have a little bit more room.
Turn that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What is it you do for, I know you work for Quest.
Right.
What do you do there?
Well, I have a kind of a hybrid role. About half of my time is spent on technology evangelism. Mm-hmm. So I write a lot of white papers, usually do a poster or two, and blogging and speaking. That's all part of my job. And then the other half of my job is around products and customers. So I spend a lot of times with customers going over products, demoing them if they need to see them for the different SQL Server things like Toad or Lightspeed.
Yeah. I think Toad's very cool. I mean, Toad was part of our road trip a year ago when we did Visual Studio Tour.
Yeah, okay.
And just seeing Oracle work the same way as SQL Server with the database administration tools in Studio was epically cool.
Yeah. So we Toad is our biggest product by volume. We have a million licensees on Toad. There is a SQL Server specific version. There's versions for MySQL, DB2, Sybase, and there's also now we're actually building out a lot. So there's Visual Studio plugins, so like Eclipse.
Right.
And it plugs into Visual Studio, so you can do all kinds of things that Microsoft probably doesn't care as much about.
No, they're focused on another area.
Exactly. So
is how the ISV business works, right? You find the holes that they've left behind, and they're not looking that way, and you can help fill them in, round out the products.
Right, right. So, I spend a good deal of my normal work week would be talking to customers. Can I answer any questions? And actually, one of the things I share with the SQL Server guys is a lot of my time is SQL Server evangelism.
Right.
So, you know, I speak Oracle, I speak Sybase, I know DB2. So we talk about, you know, why would we want to make a bigger investment in SQL Server? Or why would we want to allow it into our corporation?
It's an interesting debate because, I mean, they're all good database products. I still think the query engine on SQL Server is the best that exists. Like, I've never been able, since I think about 2000, SQL 2000, I haven't been able to fool the engine. Or
right.
How I wrote the query got a different query plan.
Sure, sure.
It's like, if this query is providing the same results, no matter how I describe it, I tend to get the same query plan every time.
Sure.
It's only when I go jumping into another database.
Mm.
And I did a whole bunch of Postgres work a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
How you crafted your query really, really mattered.
Yeah.
It was a flashback.
Yeah.
You know, to the old, oh, yes, the Sybase days.
Right.
You know, the order of these operators is going to change the way the query plan works.
Yeah. Yeah.
In some ways, we're really spoiled with SQL Server.
Yeah. It does make life a lot easier.
But by that token, you know, the rip and replace concept, I want to get Oracle out of here and put SQL Server in, like, that's incredibly risky things to do.
Yes. Yes. In fact, what we're seeing now is, we used to see homogeneous shop, you know,
right.
Just one kind of database.
We're an Oracle shop.
We're an Oracle.
SQL shop.
Exactly. Nowadays, probably 60 to 70% of our customers have two, if not three, databases.
Right.
And it used to be an either or kind of discussion, but now it's more like, how do we make this all work well?
Right.
Multicultural, you know, sort of thing. And how do we get this to coexist successfully and optimally even? That's the norm now.
Right.
It's very unusual for me to go into a shop and there's no SQL. There's no Oracle. Part of that is because of the buy versus build decision.
Right.
We finally found the product that we love that's going to save a huge amount of time. We're not going to have to build our own. Only thing is, it only runs on MySQL.
Right.
You know, or it only runs on SQL Server.
Right.
So now suddenly SQL Server has the door in.
Yeah.
And the place that was exclusively Oracle and SQL Server, like it likes to do, before the end of the year's out, you've got three of them, and then
yeah.
and next year you got another.
Well, then the developers get going, and
that's right.
You always have the debate. So, what database backend are we going to use for this one? Well,
mm-hmm.
Who's got space?
And, right.
And what's our transactional load over there? And how long can we postpone buying another machine?
Right. And then there's the whole human element too of
what skill sets have we got?
Yeah. Who's got the skills? Politically, who's the easiest to work with?
Yeah.
True. You know, who's kind of a pain to work with?
Yeah.
You know. That's another area I think where SQL Server wins a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about the raw technical things like the query processor. Yeah, SQL Server wins those arguments. You know, people used to say, it's departmental.
Yeah.
Oracle's the big, that discussion.
That argument's kind of over.
That's kind of over.
Yeah.
A lot of times now in those heterogeneous shops, the people who are winning the internal business inside the company are the people who are the best to work with.
Right.
And SQL Server people actually win that argument a lot of the time. Yeah. They're easier to work with. They're more friendly. They are more accommodating to the business. They understand the business better.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting kind of change.
I wonder why that is. Like, is it just the way the product works makes it easier to be more flexible?
That's definitely part of it. And, you know, if we were to have a bit of a philosophical conversation about that, I would even say that a little bit about the personality of the founders is reflected in the community of people who use these products.
Oracle has a reputation.
It does.
No question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. For better or worse.
That's right.
You know, that sort of strokes both ways. You know,
sure.
There's a very high bar. Most folks that I've met that are serious about Oracle are very skilled.
That's right.
There's a very high bar to get in the door with that, where I think Microsoft's really built a system where you need to know very little to get SQL Server up and running.
Mm-hmm.
You may make a big mess along the way, but, you know, there's that very gradual slope of becoming of expertise.
Yes.
And it's certainly one of the reasons that it's gotten is where it's gotten to. And also, I think one of the reasons it battled the reputation it's had.
Absolutely true on all counts. Very good analysis. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting place. The weirder one is DB2, you know?
Yeah.
That's an old database, actually.
It is.
Like, it's like one of the very first relational databases anywhere ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it has persistence. So last time I tinkered with a DB2 database was on AS400.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we were interoperating between SQL Server and AS400 AS400 DB2. And it was totally different way of thinking about the problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. DB2, you're right. I have not seen DB2 grow in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I run into a lot of people who have it. Are you going to do anything new with DB2? Nah. Are you going to get rid of it?
Nah. Yeah, and runs on some big iron.
Like, it does.
You talk about what are the mainframes doing these days? A lot of them are just running DB2.
Just
now.
Running DB2,
and
that's right.
And they've got microcomputer servers sitting in front of the DB2 that are doing all of the transactional processing and all of the computational work. You know, kicks and stuff has largely been eliminated from the loop in the big iron, but still it's a good database.
I'm not exactly sure why this thought entered my head, but one of the things too I'm seeing that is driving a lot of adoption for Microsoft is the kind of auxiliary features that you get. So let's say, for example, if you're looking at Oracle, and you're going to build out a lot of reporting.
Yeah.
Business intelligence. Well, that means you're going to get the Hyperion S-based sort of stuff. You're going to buy that in, and maybe you're going to buy Exadata. All those things are extra add-ons that you have to buy.
Yep.
If you're going with IBM stuff, then you're going to get is it Business Objects or Crystal Reports? It's going to cost a lot of money to do this something up. Where many people now are saying, well, I would be willing to pay for the relational engine, the core database. But then I have to buy all this other stuff. So when I buy SQL Server, I get integration services.
Right.
I get analysis services. I get reporting services.
Right.
I was actually having a conversation with a customer last week who said, you know, I am just sick of the enormous licensing cost on this other reporting service I have to buy to go along with my other database vendor. But when I buy Microsoft, I get reporting services with it.
Everything comes in the box.
That's right.
And it's taken a while for, I think, reporting services to mature enough to be comparable to these professional reporting products that you buy separately. But I think it's there now.
It is. I really see great stuff coming out of people who are serious about using reporting services.
I also feel the same way about analysis services. Microsoft really commoditized that market.
Right.
I remembered working in Arbor S-Base in Hyperion.
Oh, yeah.
Big ticket products, man. Like, you know, don't even talk to me if you haven't got $250,000 to spend. But now it's in the box.
Yeah.
And while you still need to spend, it still takes some skill and some time and some equipment to utilize that technology, it's a license you already own.
You know, a good index, if you're looking at, you know, what kind of indices can I look at to tell, you know, how mature and how effective a particular technology is? You can always look at what salaries people are commanding who specialize in that. And Microsoft BI people are getting top dollar right now.
Business intelligence in general.
Right.
Because it's just because the value proposition is so clear.
Yes.
You know, when you do your job properly, the company behavior changes.
Yes.
For the better.
Yes.
Period.
Uh-huh.
And I remember times that I've done BI related talks and had people run out of the room because it's like, I got to go do this right now. I'm not even going to finish the session. I'm off.
Right.
I got to do this now.
Right. You know, the flip side of that that's really kind of interesting to me as well is that, let's say I'm writing a white paper and I'm going to talk about, you know, automating database practices. I could line up a dozen people who would be willing to give me a case story or tell me their story about how they were able to do that. They're willing to share those kinds of, because that reduces costs.
Yep.
But if I were to try and write a white paper about, tell me the kind of algorithms you're doing for data mining. Tell me about the way you're constructing. People don't share those stories.
No, those are, that's,
because that generates profit.
Yeah.
And,
that's business advantage there.
That's right.
I'm going to keep that one in my pocket.
That's
Thanks
right.
Thanks very much.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think where we see improvements in operational stuff on the relational side, that's kind of additive. You know, it's 2 + 2 = 4. But when you see, you know, well done business intelligence, that's either logarithmic or multiplicative. You know, it's like 2 × 2 × 2 × 2 is now a whole different number. Rather than being 6, we're now at, what, 8?
Yeah.
16? You know, it's just a much stronger return on the investment.
Yeah. It is. That's what our stuff's all about.
Indeed.
Kevin, always fun to talk to you.
Richard, my pleasure. Good to be here.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.